bitch or a bad bitch.
Hi, Katie.
Hey, Ari.
How are you doing today?
Not good. I am living a life.
Yeah, we are not happy beans today. We did not get Taylor Swift tickets, and we are upset about it.
I didn't even get the opportunity to buy them.
Yeah, it was BS. It was the biggest bullshit in the planet. Apparently, like, 1 billion people. That's a little over-exaggeration, but I think about that many people tried to get tickets.
Their 8 billionth human was born or whatever this week, and every single one of the humans was in line on Ticketmaster. Every single one of them was in that goddamn queue.
Yeah. Yep. So sad. Well, we know who our woman crush isn't this week.
Ticketmaster. Yeah. Fuck you.
Good news today is I had a great day. I have two woman crushes.
Yeah.
Because Regina Jackson dyed my hair and cut it, and it's pink, and it's cute, and it's everything I ever wanted in my life.
So fucking
cute. I'm just so happy.
I am obsessed with it.
I'm so happy. And my tattoo artist, Lisa, again, killing it with the best tattoos ever.
And really, when you can dye your hair and ink your skin,
yeah,
who needs therapy?
Exactly. And I did it all in one day. I was like, dopamine, mine.
And after this, we're going to drown ourselves in fondue.
So much cheese and chocolate. Do we get chocolate?
I have chocolate.
Okay.
We didn't get any, but I just always have chocolate chips at home.
And alcohol. And we're gonna listen to Taylor Swift and cry, and it's fine. It's fine. It's totally fine.
It's gonna be very cathartic.
We are thriving, and it's fine that we didn't get tickets.
We are not quite 30 and not very flirty and thriving.
Okay, I beg to differ. I tried to flirt with a girl and she offered me Coke. So maybe I am thriving.
Ari did not accept.
I did not. I thought she meant Coca-Cola. I thought she was buying me a rum and Coke, and I got really excited. I was like, I love rum and Coke.
I don't flirt. I'm married. And
You don't have to. Yeah.
I guess I still flirt with JP, but like,
badly?
Less stakes. Oh, yeah, of course. It was always bad. I had to ask you when we started dating, before we started dating, if he was flirting with me. So like, flirting's not my forte.
Well, with that, because we are hungry and we want cheese, we're going to get right into the story this week, right?
Yeah. Bring it on. I'm excited to hear about your story.
Yeah, I am excited to tell you. So, I am covering the iconic Phyllis Diller.
Hell yeah.
So, she was born Phyllis Ada Driver in Lima, Ohio. Which, for some reason, Ohio has become, like, a meme.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
Because Ohio's kind of garbage.
Mm. She was born on July 17th, 1917, making her a good old Cancer.
Hey.
Now, she was the only child born into this Methodist family. And apparently, her parents were much older when they had her.
Okay.
So, because of that, she had to attend a lot of funerals at a young age, which
Jesus.
She attributed to having appreciation of life, and which she used as, like, you know, comedy as a therapy later on because of all the trauma she
went through. Who needs therapy when you have comedy?
When you got good laughs. Now, she attends school like a normal children, and she realized that she thinks she's funny, but, like, even at school, like, she was quiet and dedicated student, you know, stuck to her guns and did what she had to do. She went to school. She attended a Columbia College in Chicago, where she studied piano.
Cool.
For 3 years. But after a while, she decided that piano was not her beck and call. So instead, she transferred to Bluffton College, where she studied literature, psychology, and philosophy. Fun. But during college, she met her future husband, Sherwood Diller.
Sherwood.
I know, right? Where they got married in 1939. And she never finished school. Instead, she became a housewife. For her and her eventual 5 kids, technically, it would have been 6, but she had a miscarriage or one died at infancy. One of those. But 5 officially.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the family in 1952, they moved to Alameda, California.
Sure.
Sure. Where, so for a really long time, for like, I would say like almost 10 years, maybe actually more, a little bit more than 10 years, she was just a housewife, you know, taking care of kids, yeah, doing cool. the business.
Good for her.
But when they moved to California, she got a job working on radio.
Ooh.
And she started filming 15-minute segments also while she was doing radio on the Bay Area TV show called Phyllis Dillis, the Homely Friend Maker, where she would dress as like a very like absurd housewife, like mm-hmm. over-exaggerated, and give like really absurd fake housewife advice as like a joke.
I love that.
And so at first, her husband was very supportive. And
I don't
like
that whole at first thing.
Mm-hmm. Now, he encouraged her to actually start stand-up, which was, at the time, no woman was doing stand-up.
Okay.
It was a male-dominated place. And at this point, though, she was 37. She was pretty a late bloomer to start as a stand-up comedian.
Yeah, I mean, like, women hit their expiration date at 40.
Yeah,
we've
learned this. Yeah.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. So she starts performing stand-up in the basement of a San Francisco club called The Purple Onion. And she has her first debut on March 7th, 1955. Fun fact, this club, Maya Angelou frequently performed at this club around the same time.
Oh,
and
that's so
they like
cool.
met and became friends.
Okay. I always love when we're telling a story and we're like, oh yeah, and this other super famous person casually just their friend.
Yeah. And they're also happen to be on our list.
Yeah.
Have we covered Maya Angelou? No, we haven't. She's on the list though.
Definitely on the list.
Now her first show was such a success and everyone thought she was so funny that she booked for 89 consecutive weeks after this.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And this was what she described as perfect timing. Because she becomes more successful and financially stable around the same time her husband's business failed and she becomes the breadwinner.
Good for her.
She describes this as, and I quote, "I became a stand-up comedian because I had a sit-down husband." Woo! So she talks about this time as being very intimidated, though, because, again, she is, like, basically the first female stand-up comedian.
Right.
At a time where, like, men told women they weren't funny.
Sure.
Women weren't funny.
I mean, they still do.
No,
so.
we're not funny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Clearly.
Yeah. but she didn't let that stop her. She wrote every single one of her sets, and she would include gags and props, drawing inspiration from her educational work and her work background, as well as, like, again, that, like, housekeeper, like, mom character that she made. She would also do spoofs and parodies of like classical music and advice columns, and she would like, you know, do that. And her whole character was like the surreal version of what they thought femininity was.
Sure.
Femininity, but like over exaggerated, where she would wear like baggy clothes, or she'd be like holding like a wooden cigarette holder, and she had like this like really large, fluffy, unkept hair with this very like signature like like type cackle.
Sure.
She was like very over the top.
Yeah.
And that was like her signature character.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then one of the things that she constantly would joke about was how much of a terrible cook she was, but in reality, she was actually an excellent cook. In fact, she tried to license, I think she did, she licensed her chili recipe and sold it nationally as Phyllis Diller Chili.
I love that for her.
So it was funny. Now, she was so successful on this tour that she landed her first role on a national television show as a contestant on the quiz show called You Bet Your Life in 1958.
I do not bet my life. No, thank you.
And then she had a few appearances on the Jack Parr's Tonight Show, which led her to her basically her big break on the Ed Sullivan Show, which brought her national fame.
Love that.
Now, she continued to do her tour stand-up routine throughout the United States in the 1960s. She actually ends up releasing multiple comedian albums, some funny ones called Wet Toe in a Hot Socket, Laughs, Are You Ready for Phyllis Diller, and The Beautiful Phyllis Diller. No, fun fact, during her touring in the Greenwich Village, her opening act was the up-and-coming singer, young Barbara Streisand.
Oh my God.
Another one. Wow. Now, all throughout the 60s, she stars in multiple movies with her mentor, Bob Hope, which makes this a little problematic because if we remember in the Judy Garland episode, Judy Garland wanted nothing to do with Bob Hope because he was a sexist. Uh-huh. So it makes me very conflicted because she, and then I was reading throughout her whole story, was very supportive of Bob Hope and he was very supportive of her. So if he's supportive of a female comedian, but he's also very sexist, and it was like, what's going on here?
I mean, it...
And this isn't the first time Bob Hope has been mentioned either. I think in another one of my episodes, he was also mentioned as an asshole.
I mean, there's... Harvey Weinstein. Mm-hmm, you know, there are people that Harvey didn't do anything to and was just supportive of. And then there were the people who he victimized horribly.
Yeah.
So, like, bad people can do good things. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's how they're able to stay in power for so long.
Yeah. It's just very interesting.
Yeah.
But... See, this is why I don't like him, because he described Phyllis, and they're still friends, and they were friends till the end, but he described Phyllis as, and I quote, a Rohrhal mobile of a spare parts picked up along a freeway. What? Huh. What does that even mean? Well, parts picked up along a freeway. A Warhol? Is that a
couple? Warhol is Andy Warhol, so Andy Warhol paintings.
Warhol mobile. Of a spare parts picked up.
Probably a Warhol mobile.
Mobile. Okay, like a car?
Yeah.
Of spare parts picked up along the freeway? I was like, what do you mean by that? They didn't elaborate. They just left the quote at that, so. Anyway, around the same time, she ends up divorcing her first husband. She talks a lot about that in her autobiography, about how it just wasn't a lovely marriage towards the end.
Sure.
And yeah. So they got divorced on October 7th, 1965, where she gets remarried to her second husband, Ward Dovevin, where she ends up filing for a divorce 3 months later. Because, one, he was an alcoholic, she claimed, and also because he was bisexual.
Oh, that's not great.
I know. Weird. Weirder when I mention something later, but it's just weird. But apparently they, like, work things out, and then they stayed married for another 10 years.
Sure.
But they got divorced in 1975, where then she finally marries her last and final husband, who she called the love of her life, Robert P. Haston, and they were married until his death in 1996, and she never gets remarried after that.
Okay.
So that's a little bit of her family history. Now, one of the things that she actually was always, and till up until her death, was open about was her plastic surgery.
Okay.
She was very open and honest about all the procedures she got done. On a segment in 1993, on 2020 segment, she admitted of having undergone over 15 procedures since she was the age of 55, which include, like, belly tucks, boob jobs, like, lifts, no jobs, like, everything you could think of.
I have zero problem with people getting plastic surgery. I don't like it when they're like, no, I look like this naturally.
Yeah. Exactly.
You know, like, you do you. Just, like, own it. Nothing to be ashamed of.
Which is exactly why she actually gets the American Academia of Cosmetic Surgery. They gave her an award for her openness and bringing plastic surgery almost, like, out of the closet and, like, not being secretive about it. Because at this time, in the 90s even, like, it was, like, no one.
Yeah, no one talked.
Yeah, don't talk about it. And she was very much like, yep. I have lots of plastic surgery, and I'm proud of it.
Good for her.
Yeah, that was one of the things she was, like, known for. Now, she appears on multiple game TV shows. The Gong Show, The Mouse Factory, Night Gallery, The Muppet Show at one point, The Love Show. She also appeared on Seventh Heaven and The Drew Carey Show.
Cool.
Now, she also was very large into doing voice acting.
Yes.
She has a very distinct voice. And you've probably heard her voice.
We heard her just last weekend.
Yes, we did. I will get into that. So she's been on Robot Chicken and Family Guy. Hey Arnold, the Powerpuff Girls, Jimmy Neutron. She was Jimmy Neutron's grandmother. Remember that one episode? She was like the crazy nut. Yep. Yeah. The Wild Thornberries, King of the Hill. And again, what Katie just mentioned, what me and Katie just rewatched, and I found out that Katie has some very strong opinions on, is she was the queen ant in A Bug's Life.
Listen, it's an animator's lawless wasteland. It's not a bad movie. I just think they should own the fact that it is a lawless wasteland.
So Katie goes on about how so the ants only have two arms, two legs.
You know what?
Human
eyes. If you're going to make fun of my insanity, then let me tell
you. Okay, go
insanity.
Tell them. Because I'm. Listen, we watched the whole movie and Katie was like, just flabbergasted.
Okay, so it seems like what they did was they gave every animator a different bug, which would actually be super cool, but they like never acknowledge that. So the ants have human type eyes and two arms and two legs. They have four limbs in total, not six like normal ant does. That's fine. Lots of times they humanize animals, creatures, whatever, in movies like this. I have no problem with that, except the spider
has eight legs
and human eyes. The flies have six legs and fly eyes. The aphids are considered pets and don't even speak.
We didn't even talk about the grasshoppers that are like
the grasshoppers scarily are very accurate,
except for their eyes.
Except for their eyes. Let's see. The gypsy moth has like built-in heels into her legs.
Yeah.
She wears like boots, but it's just her legs, but she's got heels. The caterpillar has hands that are basically mittens.
Yeah.
But like everyone else has fingers.
The praying mantis has sleeves.
Yeah. It's an animator's lawless wasteland.
Yeah.
And no, I was not sober when I came up with this issue. But yes, I do still have an issue with it while I am sober.
It is on Disney Plus. Go watch it so you can listen to Phyllis Diller and then also confirm Katie's.
But also, it is like, it's one of those movies that you can reference when people are like, ew, why are millennials so woke? And it's like, well, watch A Bug's Life.
Watch A Bug's Life. The grasshopper
is literally like, listen, the little people, the poor people outnumber us. 100 to 1. But like, what are they going to do? Rise up. And then they do. And they win.
Yeah.
So, eat the rich.
Yes.
Anyway, please continue your story.
No, I love it. Now, she does retire. So we're back to Phyllis Diller now.
Yeah, sorry.
She retires.
Phyllis Diller, the ant queen.
A little bit from stand-up around 2002. She has her final, which she says is her final performance, because you know most performance at the Suncoast in Las Vegas, Nevada, where she states that about comedy, if you can't dance to comedy, forget it, because it's music. Enjoy those.
Huh.
Interesting.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, in 2004, they make a documentary about her and her life and her contribution to the comedy. And they call it Good Night, We Love You, The Life and Legend of Phyllis Diller. So if you want to watch that, it was very fun. Now, while also being an actor, she was also a published author.
Hell yeah!
And she published multiple books since 1966. She has a few like comedy ones. So she has Phyllis Diller's Housekeeping Hints, which is again the same thing with her thing. She'd give you like really bad like housekeeping advice. Yeah. But also real advice, you know, in there.
Right.
She has Phyllis Diller's Marriage Manual, The Complete Joys of Aging and How to Avoid Them. I thought that was funny. And then she has autobiography called, and this is a great name for an autobiography, which is Lampshade in a Whorehouse, My Life in Comedy by Phyllis Diller. Now, in 2003, she opened up her closet to the National Museum of American History.
Cool.
And she donates, like, so much stuff of her iconic costume pieces and as well as what she called the gag file, which is a steel cabinet with 48 files, drawers, with more than 50,000 jokes that she wrote on index cards throughout her career.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And they displayed that with some of her signature pieces, including an unkept wig, wrist-length gloves, clothes-covered boots, and a bejeweled cigarette holder.
Delightful.
Love it. Now, towards the end of her life, around her 80th birthday, which, by the way, she outlives, I think, 2 of her 5 kids.
Wow, that's brutal.
Yeah, that is sad. But she lives pretty long because she makes it to 80 and she suffers from an illness which caused her to have a pacemaker in.
Sure.
And she also has a really bad drug reaction, however, that she becomes paralyzed.
Oh, Jesus.
Now, she recovers from this through physical therapy and she reaches her 90s. And she lives to be 95.
Wow.
And she dies peacefully in her home in Brentwood, Los Angeles, where she's cremated and her ashes are then scattered in the sea.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah. Now, she left, like, such a strong legacy of being, like, the first solo female comedian, like, paving the way for so many female comedians after her. Like, people like one of my favorite, Lily Tomlinson's. Mm-hmm. Like, she looked up to Phyllis Diller and talks about her so highly. You know, like, all these very famous comedians that we know now as females, like, we thank Phyllis Diller for. I mean, we wouldn't be funny.
We would have zero sense of comedy without Phyllis Diller.
Yeah, of course.
We would be terrible. Absolutely garbage.
Now, here's what is a little weird, because I mentioned that she almost like considered divorcing her husband because he was bisexual, which is weird because she had a huge, large gay following, because gay men love strong-willed, funny women.
Right. Well, I guess there's a difference between wanting them as fans and wanting to be married to one.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. Anyways, Phyllis Diller had tons of gay fans and she apparently was okay with it. And they loved her because she was like changing the status quo and like seeing what women could do and like being funny. And she said this: "My first audience were gay people because they have a great sense of humor. Gay men have the most wonderful sense of humor and they are willing to laugh. They appeal to me and I appeal to them."
Sure.
In fact, gays love them so much that in the 6th season of All Stars of RuPaul's Drag Race, so not the 6th season of All Star of RuPaul's Drag Race, but the 6th All Stars season. Yes. Ginger Minj portrayed Phyllis Diller Snatch Game. So we've had a few Snatch Game women now, which is why that's kind of how I choose.
I respect that fully.
I was like, wow, I really like their character. They're doing, put them on the list. So Phyllis Diller was one of them. Because I really like Ginger Minj. Also, what a great name is Ginger Minj. So anyways, throughout her career, she wins so many awards. Now, one of the awards I was reading, I had to write down, because I wasn't going to write down all of them, because there was a lot. But one of them was the Golden Apple Award, which she won for, and I quote, "Most Cooperative Actress in 1966. Excuse me? Excuse me?
Uh-huh. Well, she wasn't like those other difficult women.
Uh-huh. Yeah. In fact, that was an award?
Uh-huh.
What?
Uh-huh.
Excuse me? I want... No. Uh-huh. Anyways.
Uh-huh. Gross.
She also wins the American Comedy Award for Lifetime Achievement in 1992.
Okay.
She was inducted in the St. Louis Walk of Fame in 1993 for the sole purpose because she moved there to live there for like a few years to take care of her parents. And they were like, we love you in St. Louis. You're on our Walk of Fame now. She wasn't from there. She didn't live there. She lived there for like a few years. I do too, though. Now, she was also awarded a Hollywood star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, because of course she was.
Yeah.
Because you haven't made it unless you have a star. Exactly. Like Shrek has one.
Well, that's because Shrek is love.
Yeah, and Shrek is life. Yeah. Now, she never won, but she was nominated for both a Golden Globe and a Daytime Emmy.
Cool.
And she was also given a Lifetime Achievement Award from her hometown, Lima, Ohio, in 2012.
Okay.
And where she lived for most of her life, so not St. Louis,
right?
But Alameda, California, I mentioned earlier, where she got her radio start and her TV start. On her birthday, July 17th, is now officially Phyllis Diller Day.
I love that. It's also very fun to say.
Phyllis Diller Day.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the story of the first stand-up female comedian, Phyllis Diller, who brought us amazing voices that of our childhood that I probably didn't even realize.
Yeah.
And she's like hilarious and funny, and go watch her stuff. And I loved her as the grandmother in Bug's Life. Yeah. I thought she did a great job.
Mean, yeah. I had no conspiracy theory complaints issues with her voice.
Yeah, no. She did have a pet larva.
She did have a pet aphid.
Aphid.
Which, like, no, what, no.
What is an aphid exactly?
I assumed it was an aphid, but it's like a little tiny bug.
Little tiny bug. Yeah. Okay. Huh.
Ladybugs eat aphids. That's one of the things I know about them.
Are they very similar to the little tiny red ones I always see on, like...
You know, maybe aphids are the little tiny red ones.
Ooh.
So maybe it wasn't
I always
aphid,
like,
it was just...
It's mean, but, like, those are so easy to squish, and you can make little red lines.
Awful, so you should squish...
I mean,
like, if they're on plants, they're eating
They're usually not on plants when I found them. They were, like, on sidewalks, and I would just be like, ooh, and it was, like, almost like writing in blood. Oh, this is such a weird confession. Saying it out loud. But there was, like, millions of them. You know what I'm talking about? When there was, like, tiny, tiny little red ones, like, on the side.
I mean, I always saw aphids. I only really saw aphids on, like, plants.
Uh-huh.
And they were not supposed to
I spent a lot of time outside by myself. So I would just sit up in the stoop and, like, look at stuff. And one of them was the tiny little red bugs. But where I would squish them. Okay. So, Katie, please save me from myself.
I will save you from yourself by telling you a wild, horrifying...
Ooh, I love a good... We haven't had a good...
Bad bitch story.
We haven't had a good one in a while. Well, was my last one good? I don't remember.
Your last one shoved eggs back
she
up chicken butts.
Did shove... Yeah, you're right. That's why I blocked it out.
Yeah.
I like how...
took the brain bleach.
Saida was... She was loving that episode, and I love that for her. So, tell us the story.
I will be telling you all about, and I'm not sure if I'm saying her name correctly, but she's bad, so I don't care.
So who cares?
Santa Kims.
Ooh, her name is Santa?
Santa?
Oh, Santa.
Yeah, Santa
Got
Kims.
You.
Kimmies? I don't know, Kims. I was saying it Kims in my head. Anyway. So apparently, to start off, there's some debate about whether her birth certificate was forged or not. So, starting strong.
Yeah.
But here we go. Assuming it is correct, she was born Santa Singers on July 24th, 1934, making her a Leo, in, allegedly, Oklahoma City, Oklahoma.
Okay.
She was
born. Allegedly.
I don't know what's true and what's not. But... she was one of four kids, probably. It's unclear who / what her parents were. Some claim that she was the daughter of a respectable family who ran away. She claimed that her father was a laborer and her mother was a prostitute.
Mm.
Regardless, she was a wild street kid. She, you know, caused chaos. And she also, despite this, did graduate high school in 1952. Where she had apparently been a cheerleader, a member of Glee Club, and a member of Spanish Club.
Listen.
So if you are getting Will Schuester vibes, you are correct to be afraid.
I was like, oh my God, it's Will Schuester.
Yeah, you are
Spanish
correct
teacher
to be afraid.
Who? Oh my God. Oh my God.
So she leaves high school and almost immediately marries her high school boyfriend.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Strangely, that only lasts 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
But don't worry. A few years later, she reconnects with another high school boyfriend, and they got married.
Oh, okay.
The two had a decent life at first. However, she wanted a good life, but she didn't necessarily want a lawful good life.
Mm.
So, in 1961, she was caught shoplifting, and she and her husband, Edward, separated, and then got back together, and then separated... And then got back together. And kept that cycle going for a few years. Even having a son together. Kent. Now, Santa and Edward did eventually get divorced for realsies in 1969. But Santa wasn't single for long. In 1971, she met Kenneth Kimes, a motel tycoon. So, she meets Kenneth Kimes. They marry after 10 years together, and they have a son that they named Kenneth Karam Kynes. That's right. His initials were KKK.
I'm assuming that's on purpose.
I don't know for sure, but it's, if you're feeling that this is going to start getting super problematic, you are correct.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And if you're feeling like it's a little bit of foreshadowing, you are also correct.
Ooh. We're in for a ride now.
So, I introduced most of the players of this story. So let's get into the real bad bitch stuff.
All right.
Because I mentioned earlier that she was a shoplifter, but she was a sneaky thief in a lot of ways. Now, her first son, Kent, was not about it. Her second son, Kenny, was. So she swindled people out of money, out of merchandise, even real estate.
Wow.
Through elaborate cons and forgery and theft. She would also, according to her older and not illegal son, commit insurance fraud, usually via arson.
Okay.
Now, one absolutely wild thing she did that I kind of love both of these things. She would pretend to be Elizabeth Taylor because they had a slight resemblance and, like, get in places by being Elizabeth Taylor, the actress.
Okay.
And she would also introduce her motel tycoon husband as an ambassador, a lie which got them access to the White House during the Ford administration.
What?
Now...
crazy.
Those two things, cool bad bitch. They are overshadowed by some very not cool things, which, as I mentioned, were foreshadowed, some of which were foreshadowed by her second son's initials. So, Santé would do this thing where she would go to homeless shelters, and she would find people, particularly young immigrants, especially, and I fucking hate this term, illegal immigrants, because people aren't fucking illegal, but anyway.
Yeah.
And she would offer them employment as maids in her home. She, once they got there, she would not pay them and threaten to turn them into authorities if they disobeyed her. So she basically took young homeless people that had nowhere else to go and made them her slaves.
Oh my God. What a bitch.
This is particularly egregious. I mean, like, it's awful anyway. Without any qualifiers, but she could have easily afforded to pay them. Her husband was a motel tycoon. She just didn't want to.
Okay. All right. Sure. Wow. What a bitch. Yeah.
So she and Kenneth, the husband, Kenneth is the husband, Kenny is the son. That's how I'll refer to
him. Okay. Got you.
So she and Kenneth ended up spending most of his fortune on lawyer fees. Because, you know, charges were eventually brought up against them. She was eventually arrested in 1985 and sentenced to 5 years in prison for violating those pesky anti-slavery laws. Because, see, it wasn't as punishment for a crime, where it is still technically legal.
Yep.
It was, you know, just her wanting to have some slaves.
Ew. Yep. Ew. Okay.
But don't get me off on that tangent. I'll keep telling this story. Meanwhile, Kenneth took a plea deal and signed up for an alcohol rehab program. And while Santé was in jail, Kenneth and Kenny lived relatively normal lives. And then in 1989, Santé was released and it all went downhill from there.
Oh, no.
So we're going to back up a little bit to the 1970s.
Okay.
David Kasdan is a guy that, for some reason, let Santé use his name on the deed to the Las Vegas home she, Kenneth, and Kenny were living in. Life goes on. She goes to jail. At some point, she convinces a notary to forge Kasdan's signature on a loan application using the house as collateral. Mm-hmm. And the loan is for $280,000.
Holy shit.
Kasdan ends up finding out. And understandably, loses his shit and is like, you're going to fix this or I'm going to go to the cops. So Santé does fix it by ordering his murder. That's right. Santé was like, Kenny, my dear, my sweet, would you go do a murder for mommy? And he did. Kenny went to Kasdan's home.
Uh-huh.
Shot him in the back of the head.
Oh.
And then he, Santé, and a third accomplice, not Dad. Dad dies in 1994. And this happens in 1998.
Uh-huh.
But they throw his body into a dumpster, disassemble the gun, and throw it into pieces in the sewer.
Uh-huh. Okay. Oh.
Now, this happens in March. And by June of the same year, they're on to their next big target. Irene Silverman, the Manhattan socialite. Now, she's like 83.
Oh, my God.
She owns a $7.7 million mansion, and she rents rooms in it, one of which Santa and Kenny decide to rent.
Mm.
They rent in June, and in July, Irene is reported missing.
Uh-oh.
And her body, never found. However, that doesn't mean there wasn't justice for her.
Okay, good. I'm a poor old lady. So, opening up her mansion for the delinquents.
So basically, shortly after they dispose of Kasdan's body, it was found.
Oh.
And the LAPD and the FBI begin investigating. And they quickly discover the forged signature on that big loan.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So they go to the house that Kasdan supposedly owned, only to find it not only occupied by a technically homeless man, but also partially burned down.
Oh.
So David McCarron is the guy that was living there, and he told the police that Santa and Kenny forced him to stay there in hopes that they would be able to collect the insurance money for the accidental fire arson. Then the FBI locates this guy, Stan, who at first they're like, hey, what do you know? And he's like, nah, man, I'm not a fucking snitch. And they're like, cool, so you are an accessory to murder and mortgage fraud? And he's like, yeah, I sold Kenny a gun. Here's everything I know. So that's all going on. And in June, when Santa and Kenny rent that room, Stan gets a call from Santa. And she's like, hey, my landlady, who's like super rich and super old, wants to sell her super expensive townhouse. Would you come help us with the paperwork?
Mm.
To which Stan says, yeah, for sure. How's July? And then immediately tells the FBI.
Good, good.
So Stan meets up with the two of them. And as soon as they're both there, the FBI moves in to make the arrest. They also find that Santa and Kenny were in possession of a stolen car.
Sounds
about
right.
Because of course they were.
Yeah,
So they search it and found what was described as a treasure trove of evidence.
Oh.
They find handcuffs, a stun gun, documents relating to Irene's mansion, handguns, forged social security cards,
uh-huh.
and notebooks in which Santa wrote ridiculously detailed schemes and plots and potential victims.
All right. Wow.
They also find notes from Irene, the murdered
the old lady
that was talking about how suspicious the two people were.
Oh, poor lady.
So even though they killed Kasdan first, they were tried for Irene's murder first. Now, this was a wild story in the media for a lot of reasons, but the top two were that it was a mother-son duo and that there was no body. So, like, why?
Nobody, no crime.
Yeah, exactly.
Taylor said it.
Nobody, no crime. What was also wild is that the judge ordered Santa not to speak to the media, even after the jury was sequestered, because she was trying to pass notes to reporters and influence the jury.
Oh my gosh.
However, despite a body never being recovered, the evidence was so damning that the jury ended up being unanimous in convicting them not only of murder, but of 117 other charges.
Wow.
Including grand larceny, burglary, illegal weapons possessions, forgery, and eavesdropping.
And grand theft auto, because they stole that car.
Yes, yeah, I believe that was the grand larceny.
Oh, is that the same thing?
Yeah, I don't know.
Oh, okay.
I have no clue.
Okay.
I'm not a lawyer. So, during the sentencing, Santa goes on a rant, during which she claims they were framed by the cops and the lawyers. She compares their trial to that of the Salem witch trials. She says that the prosecution was guilty of murdering the Constitution. And eventually the judge is like, I need you to shut up.
Stop talking.
The judge then says that Santa was, and I quote, a sociopath and a degenerate, and her son was a dupe and a remorseless predator. They are then sentenced to they are given the maximum sentence.
Good.
Which is 120 years for Santa and 124 for Kenny.
Holy shit. Good.
And this is just for the murder of Irene. This is just for that case. They have not been tried for the other guy yet.
Oh, good.
So in 2000, which is the year after this trial, Kenny is being interviewed by a court TV reporter, and he ends up holding her hostage using a ballpoint pen held to her throat.
What?
And demands that his mother not be extradited to California because in California they were facing the death penalty.
Oh.
Now, he ends up, there's negotiation for 4 hours before somehow a distraction is caused. They're able to tackle him, get the court reporter away. Saves the day. No one's hurt. So, in March 2001, Kenny is extradited to California to stand trial. Sante was extradited in June. Now, during Kenny's trial, which was first, he changed his plea to guilty in exchange for a plea deal that his mommy not get the death penalty if she's convicted.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
He then testifies against his mother and spills every single dirty detail. Well, if she's convicted, she's not going to get the death penalty.
Got you. Okay,
because they made the deal.
So he, right.
Now, okay. Sante, despite all of this, makes another statement at her second sentencing, saying basically all of the same things. She's cut off by the second judge, who says Sante was, and I quote, one of the most evil individuals she'd met in her time as a judge.
Wow. That's... All right.
Sante and Kenny were both sentenced to life imprisonment after the second trial, which they effectively had anyway.
Yeah.
And Sante spent the rest of her life in the Bedford Hills Correctional Facility for Women in New York, where she died on May 19th, 2014, at the age of 79. Kenny's still kicking in whatever California prison he's rotting in.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the year of her trial, a made-for-TV movie came out starring Mary Tyler Moore as Sante.
Who's that? That's,
Mary Tyler Moore had the Mary Tyler Moore Show.
Yeah.
She was, like, an older famous comedian.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know her then.
And it was called, like, Mother Like Son, The Strange Story of Sante and Kenny Kims. In 2006, another television movie came out, A Little Thing Called Murder.
Oh.
Sante was also featured in a 2009 episode of The Dateline and a 2015 episode of Diabolical Women.
Hmm.
The story was recounted on Oxygen's Snapped in an episode that aired on August 30th, 2020. Gary Indiana wrote a novel, Depraved Indifference, in 2009, which is basically based on their case.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The season 5 episode of Cold Case, Thick as Thieves, and the season 9 episode Venom of Law and Order are based on their story.
Hmm.
And Son of a Grifter was written by Sante's not criminal son, Kent, where he tells his side of the story.
Kent's like, my mom's going to be a criminal. I'm gonna bank off this.
Listen, mom left me and she was awful. I'm making my money. Yeah. Hell yeah, Kent. Good for you.
Yeah, good for you. Not doing murders.
Good job not doing murders for mommy.
Yeah.
And that is the story of Sante Kims and her wild grifter turned mother life.
Wild. I was going to say good for her, but no.
No, not good for her.
Not here today. No. Bad for her.
No, I picked her because I was like, oh, bad bitch on our list that falls roughly in your
time. Same time, right? Yeah.
Perfect. Sounds great. And then I looked up and I was like, oh, cool, like a grifter, and she had her son do murders? No.
Yeah. Pretty gruesome murder, too.
Yeah.
Oof.
Yep. No.
They never said to, because, like, the other guy was shot in the head, so I'm trying to think how they killed a little old lady.
I did find that information. I can tell you if you'd like. I just didn't include it in the story.
Is it bad?
I mean, she was murdered, so
yes. How'd they kill her?
They used a stun gun and then strangled her.
That's even worse. Oh, that's sad.
And also left her in a dumpster.
Oh, I thought they didn't find her body, though.
I mean, they didn't, but they told where
they dropped her in the phone. Yeah, love that. Yeah, cool.
Yeah, because there were detailed notes as to everything that they did in the notebook.
Oh, that's so sad.
Yeah.
Sad days. Yeah. Well, we want cheese, so I'm going to tell you where you can find us real quick, because I'm so hungry.
Yeah.
So find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, GBBB Podcast.
3 Bs.
Yep. And then you can email us at
goodbebadbepodcast@gmail.com.
Or leave us a good review on anything. Recommend us to your friends. Join our Patreon.
Love us. Go have some cheese for us. Go have some melty cheese. I promise it'll make you feel better after that horrifying story.
Yeah, sorry I'm rushing us, but I just was thinking about it the whole time.
Have a great week, friends.
Yeah, see you later. Bye.
Are you a good witch or a bad witch? Bad witch. Bad, bad, bad. Are you a good witch or a bad witch?
Me? I'm not a witch at all.
Are you a good witch or a bad witch?
Me? I'm not a witch at all.
Are you a good witch?